Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Republican Senate measure to revamp the Affordable Care Act has been put on a short hiatus while GOP leadership works over the Independence Day holiday to muster enough votes to pass it. Coming up, we'll talk with two Ohio think tanks about what works and what doesn't in the proposal. Joining us now is Washington Post health policy reporter Paige Winfield Cunningham. Welcome to the show.
Great to be on.
I think I like the description of the process of mustering votes is a wheelbarrow full of bullfrogs. Every time you put one in, another one jumps out. What are the tipping points at stake as far as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is concerned in getting this thing passed?
Well, you know, his real trick here is that he can't just appeal to the moderates or just appeal to the conservatives with this bill. He's really got to appeal to everybody because he can only lose two votes. And so that's the tricky pathway that he sort of faces with this legislation. So I think the thing to watch over the next few weeks, and we're hearing it's most likely at this point that the Senate's going to vote on the health care bill, not until July. But he's going to have to change this measure so that it appeals to moderates like Dean Heller, like Susan Collins, who have said to this point they're not going to vote for the bill as it is. He probably needs to add in possibly more generous subsidies, perhaps a slower phase out of Medicaid expansion, perhaps roll back some of the Medicaid cuts to kind of assure them and really give them political cover for voting for this bill. Because, of course, these moderates are up against the perception and the reality that this would cause more people to lose their insurance coverage compared to the Affordable Care Act. On the flip side, McConnell needs to get conservatives like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee on board. They've also said they're not going to vote for the bill as is. And they want to see that the bill repeals more of the Affordable Care Act, rolls back even more of the insurance regulations. There's some of that already in the Senate bill, but they want to see even more. And so that's what's really, really hard for McConnell as he kind of tries to find a path forward.
It's hard. Is it even possible?
That's sort of the million-dollar question, isn't it? When you look at McConnell and who he is, I think there's a lot of confidence around Washington that he has sort of the negotiation chops, if you will, to kind of, you know, maneuver enough support for this bill. I guess the thing that makes me feel more bullish about his prospects is that when you look at back at the House was passing its health care bill over the spring, and there were quite a number of times when it seemed completely dead. The moderates were coming out against it. The Freedom Caucus was coming out against it. And, you know, Paul Ryan is nowhere near the master negotiator that McConnell is seen as. Even so, the House still managed to pass its bill by adding in amendments here and there, which was able to eventually get them across that threshold that they needed to pass it. And so, you know, if the House was able to do the seemingly impossible, you know, the Senate could as well. That said, you know, I don't think anybody really knows how it's all going to play out in July. And of course, the senators could come back after the July 4th recess even more reticent to vote for this legislation because they're going to be hearing from constituents in their home states who are really unpleased about, you know, how this bill is projected to roll back Medicaid spending and result in a higher uninsured rate than under current law.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about health care reform or whatever you want to call it in Washington. My guest is a health policy reporter for The Washington Post, Paige Winfield Cunningham. Questions or comments come up later in the program. So listen, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Senate Republicans met with the president yesterday. What happened in that meeting that hasn't happened before?
Well, you know, Trump got all of these Republicans in the East Room of the White House and I think to some extent allowed them to air their complaints about this process. I mean, a lot of the senators have been really displeased and even stated this publicly that they don't like how McConnell wrote the bill behind closed doors. I think McConnell did make an effort at first to get this group of 12 or so Republicans together to write something, but they ultimately realized they couldn't agree on anything. And so that's why McConnell kind of took over the process. But Trump got all these senators in the room. They sort of let them, you know, air their complaints and then really urged them to find a way to come on board and support this. you know, I think it was the move that he had to make at this point because, you know, leadership is really going to have some heart-to-hearts with senators if they're going to pick off enough people to vote for it. And the Republicans need assurance that they're going to get backing from the White House, they're going to get backing from leadership if they go ahead and vote for this bill, especially like Heller, who's facing a tough re-election next year, and also Jeff Flake in Arizona. And at the same time, there are a lot of doubts about how effective Trump is in reaching these Republicans. I mean, during the negotiations over the House bill, he didn't seem to be very effective and even said and tweeted things sometimes that seemed to make things even harder for Republicans, you know, his comments about the bill being mean and heartless and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think the White House needed to show that it was reaching out to these Republicans, show that it's backing the effort, show that it really wants to get this done. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure that Trump himself is going to be the one to, you know, move the needle on whether the fence-sitting Republicans ultimately decide to vote for this measure.
Senator Marco Rubio of Florida talked yesterday about the costs of failure, one being that if Republicans fail and the insurance markets collapse, Republicans would then be having to take blame for that and fighting off a single-payer proposal. That's the second time, I think, I've heard that pop up in a national news story regarding this issue. Is single-payer actually something that's possible?
I would say probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to hear single payer a lot because Bernie Sanders talked about it. There's going to be Democrats further to the left that are going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, there were Democrats that wanted to make the Affordable Care Act a single payer system.
Right.
And there just wasn't the political will for that at the time. And I don't think much has changed. If anything, things have shifted more to the right, more against single payer. And so I think that's really kind of a fringe thing at this point. But you're right that there needs to be action taken on the marketplaces. And what's interesting is that, you know, a lot of Republicans' predictions about the marketplaces sort of are coming true in some parts of the country. Things are not looking good for 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, that may be their strongest argument for passing a health care bill is that something needs to be done. There needs to be some interventions made so that health care is more affordable for people. That said, they don't actually have evidence that the plan they're proposing would make health insurance affordable for many people. It would for some, but certainly not for everybody. But you know, that is sort of this outstanding, it's sort of the elephant in the room, if you will, is the situation of the marketplaces. But the other part is, politically speaking, if Republicans don't vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they will have gone back on their campaign promise they have made for 7 years now. They have won the House and Senate multiple times on this campaign promise. And I think if they don't hold a vote, McConnell really realizes that the base will be really angry in 2018, and they really need to shore up their base next year.
And yet the polls show that Americans are largely supportive of the Affordable Care Act. They want the Medicaid to stay the way it is, if not fund it at a higher level.
Well, so the support for the Affordable Care Act has been sort of around the 50% mark for most of the time, a little bit lower. You're right that it's been going up a little bit more recently. And yeah, that's a really big public relations problem that Republicans have. You know, I think your average voter doesn't really understand all of the policies contained within the Affordable Care Act. They don't totally understand the Republican bill. I mean, health policy is very, very confusing.
Well, the Republicans don't totally understand it.
Republicans themselves don't totally understand it. Exactly. At the end of the day, though, people do understand what Medicaid is. For example, Medicaid's been around for a really long time, and Republicans are trying to enact some pretty big cuts to federal Medicaid spending in this bill. It's something they've wanted to do for a really long time, and they make the argument that, you know, it's too expensive for states and you have to kind of rein in this program. But what they're really up against is that Medicaid is a relatively popular program. It has succeeded in covering a lot of low-income people around the country. And so that's one of the biggest or most difficult selling points that they have for this bill is contained in those Medicaid cuts. And that's why you may see some pulling back on that by McConnell as he tries to get the moderates on board.
And then, of course, you know, another bullfrog jumps out of the wheelbarrow among the conservatives.
Right. Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, any member who's sitting on the fence right now needs to have some kind of change to the bill, some amendment that they can take back to their state and say, hey, look, I made the bill better. This is why I can vote for the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might see some of those changes for moderates. But then on the flip side, you probably would need to see some more concessions to conservatives as well. And so the measure we're seeing right now probably will probably get revised quite a bit over the next few weeks.
And even if something passes in the Senate or when, it still must be reconciled with the House. And what are the odds of that?
That's going to be an even harder task because there are a lot of things in the Senate bill now that certainly Freedom Caucus members in the House aren't going to like. I mean, they want a faster phase out of Medicaid expansion, for example. The House bill would have basically ended these extra federal payments for the most part in 2020, whereas the Senate bill wouldn't actually end them completely until 2025. So that's going to be really tricky provision to sell to the Freedom Caucus folks. The Senate bill also retains some of the insurer regulations, the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. The House bill would have provided waivers for states to get out of some of those requirements for these sicker people to be charged the same amount as the healthier people. And that's something that conservatives really want a big opt-out of the insurance regulations under Obamacare because they're saying those are the things that are driving up premium costs. And so even with the Senate bill as it stands now, it's highly doubtful whether that could even pass the House. At the same time, there is a sense, or there is a thought among some congressional watchers here in D.C. is that if the Senate passes the bill, you send it over the House, you tell the House members, here's your Obamacare repeal bill. This is your one chance to do it. They might just decide to come on board, get it done, and send it to President Trump. But that remains to be seen.
And does it help that, or does it, what's the impact, I should say, of folks like Ohio Governor John Kasich traveling to Washington and, you know, on national television, constantly talking about this and criticizing the bill?
Well, I think you see it if you look at Ohio Senator Rob Portman. You know, Portman isn't usually seen as one of the more moderate members. I mean, he's not the most conservative either, but mm-hmm. he has really been one of the voices at the forefront of opposition to this bill. You know, as you said, Ohio has been one of the Republican states that largely embraced many provisions of the Affordable Care Act. Kasich expanded Medicaid and so Portman is going to find it really, really hard to vote for this bill, despite his own personal political feelings. And so I think that's why you've really seen him. You know, he actually came out yesterday after McConnell announced that the vote wouldn't happen this week. And he said, oh, by the way, I actually oppose this bill now, and came out with a pretty firm statement. And so he's kind of putting himself out there as someone who McConnell and leadership is really going to have to court pretty heavily if they want to bring him on back on board.
You know, conversely, there's a super PAC for President Trump that's been in Nevada trashing a Republican incumbent there who's running for reelection for his lack of support for the bill. What about that?
Right. Well, that was something that actually really frustrated McConnell. You know, there were reports that over the weekend he said, this is crazy. Like, my members are already having trouble unifying on this. And now we have basically this, you know, this PAC attacking one of our own. And it's interesting. You have actually seen it. This PAC took the ads down against Heller after Heller, I guess, apparently expressed frustration to Trump himself at this White House meeting yesterday and said, hey, if you know, this is not the way to make me happier about this bill.
Yeah.
So, yes, so strategically, maybe something they're recognizing they need to pull back on. Maybe they need to treat these senators a little more gently and circumspectly if they want to, you know, entice them back.
Well, and also, by the way, back at the ranch, they only hold the Senate by a couple seats. It's razor thin, really.
Right. Well, it's such a narrow threshold. You know, they can only lose two votes. And, you know, I think most people have assumed that Rand Paul, Kentucky, the libertarian-minded senator, mm-hmm. is probably never going to vote for this bill. He's
right.
been the one that basically has been opposed. He's actually the only Republican who voted against the resolution to even start work on the bill earlier this year. He wants to see all of the Affordable Care Act repealed, basically. And so he has not been shy about his frustration with all of this. You're probably losing him. That means that McConnell can only lose one more member, could be one of the moderates. if that's the case, he's got to get every other conservative and every other moderate on board. So very, very hard.
And do they ever have the philosophical discussion about the role of healthcare in a modern society? Do they ever get down to that kind of, you know, beyond the, you know, away from the granular and to that larger overarching philosophy?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, because I did a story earlier this year where I actually went to different House Republicans and I asked them, what should the government's role be in providing health coverage for people? And answers all over the place, all across the spectrum. You know, I think this issue is easier for Democrats to rally around because they tend to believe in a more robust role of government in subsidizing people's coverage and providing Medicaid. Republicans generally want to strengthen the private sector and reduce the government's role. But the hard part with healthcare is that it's so expensive and health insurance is so expensive that we're not at a point that most people can afford it. I mean, even people that get health coverage through their employer, for the most part, that is heavily subsidized. Their premiums are heavily subsidized by their employer. And so I think that's the really tricky question that Republicans have been unable to solve, is that how do you make this product cheap enough so that people are able to buy it without government subsidies? They haven't solved it, and that's why you see in the Senate bill, it basically retains the Obamacare subsidies with only a few tweaks. It sort of makes them, it pegs them to like a lower benchmark plan and makes them a little bit less generous, but it basically operates under the same idea of, you know, allowing these lower income people to buy private coverage, but then giving them government subsidies to make it more affordable for them.
Paige Winfield Cunningham, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Paige Cunningham is a health policy reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, more conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Senate efforts to overhaul the Affordable Care Act. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell postponed this week's vote on what the Republican majority has dubbed the Better Health Care Act. But McConnell's GOP majority returns after the July 4 holiday to face the music on a measure that would cut Medicaid spending by 26% and phase out funding for Medicaid expansion, an expansion that has covered about 700,000 people in Ohio alone since Obamacare went into effect 3 years ago. So joining us now is Executive Vice President at the conservative think tank, the Buckeye Institute, Ray Hederman. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Ann.
Also, Executive Director of the liberal think tank Progress Ohio, Sandy Tice. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann.
And Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Agnes Carey, on Monday, Mitch McConnell described the bill as preserving access to care for patients with pre-existing conditions. How, you know, he kind of singled that out with a few other things. How big of an issue is that at this point, and how much does it cost the bottom line, that preservation of access with pre-existing?
You might recall that under the House passed Republican plan, there were some abilities for an insurer to get around the coverage for pre-existing medical condition if somebody had a gap of 63 days or more. And so, as you mentioned, Senator McConnell made that paramount in their discussions, and many Republicans in the Senate had said, as this bill became to fruition, that we want to protect people with a pre-existing medical condition. But here's something about the Senate bill that might interfere with that goal. There is an ability under a waiver process for a state to get a waiver for insurers in their states to cover all 10 essential health benefits that are included in the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. These are things like maternity care, prescription drugs, mental health services that are mandated in not only ACA, but the small group and the individual market plan sold on and off the exchange. If there was a way for, if an insurer got a waiver from offering some of those things and you had a condition that was covered by an essential health benefit, you became pregnant, you needed a certain level of mental health services and they were no longer covered, then in effect, your pre-existing medical condition would not be covered. Now, a proponent of these waivers would say that the insurers would look at other alternatives to cover that, and there's various things in the bill to help provide financial assistance and incentives to help people who have had some issues with their coverage. But it's one of those intersections. I know you were talking with your prior guest about how to make insurance affordable, how to reduce the premiums, reduce deductibles, copays. There's a debate about whether or not this bill does that, but that's one thought. If insurance doesn't have to be so comprehensive, it's not so expensive.
Right. And when he says that, though, that's with an asterisk beside it then, right?
I think you have to look at it because the way that these have been drafted, these waivers, this is a, we should also say for clarity, under the existing Affordable Care Act, there is a, it's called Section 1332. It's a waiver provision that says if a state can come up with a different way to hit all the same metrics and coverage and affordability of the Affordable Care Act, that they could ask the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services if they could do that. The difference is here that the way analysts are looking at the 1332 waiver in the Senate Republican bill is it would give much more leeway for states to do what they want to do, and as long as it doesn't increase the federal deficit, they would have the power to do it. They wouldn't have to wait for the Secretary of Health and Human Services to say yes.
So many moving parts. Sandy Tice, what is your sense, your analysis of that provision that where Mitch McConnell says it's preserving access to care for patients with pre-existing conditions except for?
I think what they're trying to do is make it easier to uninsure people who have a pre-existing condition because they're expensive. Those are the people who need the insurance. And I think of all the things I've seen observing politics, this bill and the House passed bill are two of the meanest things I've ever seen. It's dangerous. They're both dangerous. They will hurt our health and they'll hurt our economy.
Ray, what do you make of that? I mean, everything has an asterisk next to it. Like I said, it's going to preserve access to care for patients with pre-existing conditions, but for.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
You know, we learn from experience. And, you know, when you require insurers to cover everybody through guaranteed issue, paid by the same rate through community rating, if you don't put in protections, people game the system. They don't enroll insurance till they're sick. New York, New Jersey tried this, and what happened is their insurance markets blew up. We're looking at, you know, massive price increases. Insurers just dropped out. That's what created the individual mandate. So what we're trying to say is if we're going to require insurers to cover everybody, how do we make sure that people are sitting there and really using insurance where you're paying premiums in a timely fashion? And that's what this provision is trying to do, to prevent people from only trying to use insurance when they're sick. Otherwise, we have an unstable insurance market, and that's what we're seeing now.
But they're saying that there's an ability to waive for a waiver process for entire states.
Yeah, you know what? And Ann, that's exciting because, you know, our other guest mentioned that the Section 1332s, and today the General Assembly is going to pass an Ohio budget that instructs the state to seek a 1332 waiver.
Why is that exciting?
Because it basically says that the state of Ohio is going to take a look and say what coverage makes the most sense for Ohio citizens. Can the state of Ohio deliver better health care at a more affordable cost, bring insurers back in the market, as compared to the dictates under the federally mandated system? So I think Ohio had a very strong competitive insurance market before the ACA, and Section 1332s can start getting us back to a place where premiums were more affordable for people.
The reason why we have an unstable insurance market is because the uncertainty in the market that was created by the uncertainty over what the future of the Affordable Care Act is. If you're an insurance company, you want to spread the risk around. You want to make sure that you're insuring both healthy people and sick people so you can spread the risk around. And when Anthem pulled out, they pulled out because they had no idea what the market forces were going to be like in Ohio and what type of people they would be required to insure. Donald Trump and the Republicans created the instability in the market, and now they're saying, oh, the market's collapsing.
But Sandy, I mean, you had insurers pulling out when President Obama was still in the White House. I mean, insurers pulling out of Ohio is not a phenomenon
right.
We can lay at President Trump's
doors. And Democrats at the time, Mary Agnes Carey, said, we need to fix things. We want to work on this, right? But the Republicans in the House and who control the House and the Senate don't want to do that. They don't want to tweak Obamacare.
Well, if you go back to the summer of 2009, when Max Baucus was head of the Senate Finance Committee, and he worked really hard to try to get Republicans on the Affordable Care Act, and ultimately none of them voted for it. So, you know, we have a situation where we've had this very strong political divide over the issue of the Affordable Care Act, over some of the things we're talking about this morning, the amount of government regulation on the insurance market, whether it's what has to be covered or what the subsidies are, and a variety of other things, and now Medicaid is coming into that, how the government funds Medicaid. It's this really strong, powerful philosophical divide. In the House, we've had, I think, more than 60 votes to repeal all or part of the Affordable Care Act. So, yes, you're right. No one is talking to each other about how to look at the underlying bill and fix it.
Well, and speaking of Medicaid, Mitch McConnell also has said that the bill would strengthen Medicaid. And I'm wondering how so. They're talking about a huge cut, and they're also looking at caps for states instead of, you know, the outlay, the way they've meted out the money in the past. How does that strengthen Medicaid? Is he talking about financially, or is he talking about Medicaid for people as being strengthened?
I look at it through, if I understand their positions correctly, I think that Senator McConnell and other Republicans feel that there are too many government regulations, requirements on states on what they have to do, what they have to cover in Medicaid and how they have to do it. And what the House and the Senate Republican bills would do is lift some of those restrictions. They talk about flexibility, wanting to give states more flexibility. But what was really an eye-opener for me yesterday was when the State Medicaid Directors Organization. Now, these are folks that run the Medicaid programs. It's a shared federal-state program all over the country.
It used to be about 60-40, 65-35 or something like that.
Now yeah, it's 90, roughly about 57%. In the federal match and the state match is roughly 57%. But you're talking about, I think, the feds picking up the cost of the new enrollers. But nonetheless, when the Medicaid directors came out and said there's no level of flexibility that can help us recover from these funding changes. So here's the thing. The baseline spending, yes, it would continue to grow every year, but overall, over the next decade, the Congressional Budget Office, which is, we call it the CBO, it's the official scorekeeper here, talks about a 26% cut over current spending projections, $772 billion less on the federal government spending for Medicaid. And let's remember, the nature of the funding system is going to change. Right now, we talked about the formula program. States are matched on a percentage basis for what they spend. There's no cap. This would say states could they would pick two different ways to get a capped allotment. It would be set when a state would have to use that allotment to deal with their Medicaid population. That's a fundamental change in the program since its creation in 1965.
Ray Hederman, both you and Sandy are nodding your heads, but for different reasons. I don't think it's radio, but I can tell you, you're both. What are you nodding your head about?
Sure. You know, I think the key is that Medicaid is an open-ended entitlement, which means that basically the more the state spends, the more they draw down on the federal government.
Right.
So I think one of the things that Leader McConnell is talking about is how do you make Medicaid simply, you know, more sustainable for the future. I mean, Medicaid has continued to grow as a percentage of the federal budget and then as a percentage of the state budget. Because it's an open-ended program, certain states, you know, richer states can spend more on the program compared to low-income states. What the Republican plans do is let's get rid of the bad incentives where states can spend more money to draw down federal dollars and instead put Medicaid on a budget, which would be a substantial reform, and then give states flexibility to treat patients differently. What they do is they divide the Medicaid enrollees into a couple of different categories. Some of these categories, disabled children, elderly, for example, they're not really going to be affected. What they're trying to look at is healthy adults and how can we lower the Medicaid reimbursement rates for them and maybe even better transition them out of the Medicaid program into private coverage.
How do you know that states won't go after fragile children?
So because there's no financial incentive. So if you take a look at kind of how the Congressional Budget Office do, and let me actually say that if a state can figure out a better way to provide health care for, you know, disabled children, we should do so. What I'm saying is the reimbursement rate for that category is right now the expenditures that you're getting still a better deal, according to the CBO analysis, for the next 10 years. So, you know, they're not really affected. Instead, what the Republican plan is, let's take a look at this expansion population, which is healthy adults, and figure out ways to move them out of Medicaid into different coverage.
Sandy, what are you nodding your head for as Mary Agnes Carey talks?
Well, when he talked about the way we need to make Medicaid more sustainable, what we need to do is we need to improve our economy. We've already seen the decline in the steel industry, in the retail sector. This bill would take a direct hit on the one remaining growth sector in our economy, and that's the healthcare sector. And that's why the American Hospital Association has so strongly opposed this. Some of the biggest employers, particularly in rural Ohio, are the local hospitals. And this would take away tens of thousands of hospital jobs. These are good-paying, family-sustaining jobs. You also mentioned the term entitlement. Here's the entitlement in this budget. The 400 richest families in America would get an average of a $7 million a year tax cut in the Senate passed bill. I am so tired of people saying all we have to do is cut taxes in our state and everything will improve. We've been cutting them for a long time. Wages are flat. Our General Assembly passed a law that banned cities from raising their minimum wage. So we have more people working full-time, living below the poverty line, and now we're going to try to take a bite out of the jobs that still are growing in our state.
Mary Agnes Carey, are they talking about that at the federal level, those issues of employment? Because we know still the most people who the biggest group of people that have insurance coverage are ones who get it through their employer still, but that is going down. And we also know the NPR, All Things Considered, just did a great report on the hospital in Steubenville, Ohio, and how if they could lose 20% of their patient load, Medicaid-funded patient load, if this passes.
Right. Proponents of the Medicaid expansion and people who are opposing these changes in Medicaid funding in the House and Senate Republican plans are absolutely addressing it through those two views, if you will. Number one, it is a job creator, how it has created jobs in many communities, especially in hospitals, but also what has happened with that Medicaid expansion. That is something in the Affordable Care Act that said if a state wanted to, it could expand Medicaid coverage to individuals making up to $16,000 a year, and that the federal government would pay, starting at 100% of the cost for that expanded population, it would taper down to 90%. So this is a decision if states, at about 31 states in the District of Columbia, expanded their Medicaid programs, if a state went through that Medicaid expansion and has added people to the rolls, they have also been taking additional money from the federal government, which would be sunsetted in the Senate Republican plan after about 3 to 4 years. That additional funding would no longer be there. That's going to create a problem for states. The Congressional Budget Office, again, our official scorekeeper here, mm-hmm. The CBO, has says 15 million fewer people would be enrolled in Medicaid than projected over the next decade if these funding changes in the Senate bill went forward.
We're going to continue our conversation. You just heard from Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Sandy Tice, executive director of Progress Ohio, and Ray Hederman, executive vice president of the Buckeye Institute. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new poll sponsored by the American Medical Association shows that most Ohio voters are not keen to cut spending on Medicaid. The polls show that 47% want spending to stay the same and 32% want it increased. That's not what Senate Republicans in Washington have in mind. The current version of the measure would cut Medicaid spending by 26%, change how it's meted out, and phase out the expansion. We're talking about what that means for Ohio. Still with us is his executive vice president at the conservative think tank, the Buckeye Institute, Ray Hederman. Ray, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
And also executive director of the liberal think tank, Progress Ohio, Sandy Tice. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ian.
And on by phone, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey. Mary Agnes, thanks again. Mary Agnes, what are the conservative hardliners after? Do they want to go back to the way things were before the Affordable Care Act, before Obamacare?
I think when you talk to, if you were to talk to Ted Cruz of Texas or to Rand Paul or to Michael Lee of Utah, they would tell you that the problem with the Senate Republican proposal on the Affordable Care Act is it's too much like the Affordable Care Act. They would like it gone. They would not perhaps want the exchanges. They would not want the requirements of coverage. Some of those things still remain. For example, a coverage of preventive services with no out-of-pocket cost is still in the bill. They think it is Obamacare light, and that is their issue, and that's part of the reason that Senator McConnell had such a problem yesterday and had to pull the bill because he couldn't even get the votes on something called the motion to proceed, which simply means you start debate on the bill. And so you have conservatives that think it's too much like the Affordable Care Act. You have senators like Senator Portman of Ohio, who's very concerned about the Medicaid changes, what that does for opioid addiction treatment, that are, you know, in the moderate camp, there's issues. So it's that kind of tug of war that increases that list of senators who are not with him, and he's going to try to win back and get a vote after the July 4th recess.
You know, Ray Hederman, I want to take a step back. You know, I want you to address what Mary Agnes just talked about as far as the bottom line. I don't think Buckeye Institute wants to go back to the way things were before. But what about the issue of employment and hospitals and the whole healthcare piece of that?
You know, I think that employment in hospitals will continue to increase because we're an aging population. We're going to continue to spend a lot of money on health care. But let's remember where the spending comes from. That spending comes from tax dollars. And so what we're saying is we're going to tax individuals and businesses more to transfer that money to the healthcare sector. And so you always need to think about still workers who are now paying higher premiums because the Obamacare taxed health insurance premiums. You need to take a look at business owners who are paying higher taxes. And then you take a look at health companies, prescription companies that are paying higher taxes as well. All these are contributing to fewer jobs in these other sectors. So I don't really think it's a net gain that if we're taxing steel companies more, causing less employment in manufacturing, to increase employment in hospitals. So I'm not as concerned about the job growth. And again, if you look at what this Congressional Budget Office said when they originally looked at the Affordable Care Act, they said this legislation will reduce employment in the United States. The number of people, number of hours of work
but
will
has
fall.
It?
Absolutely, because you sit there and say you're taxing people, people are working less.
But
and then the other thing with
how
Medicaid,
do you draw a line to that, though? I mean, there's maybe a correlation in some sectors, but
so when the Congressional Budget Office takes a look, they have their models that say when you increase taxes, a certain amount of work hours are going to fall. That was the first thing. The second thing they said is that when you expand Medicaid to able-bodied adults, that's never happened before, people are no longer going to have to work because sometimes people are working to get insurance. That's why in the new CBO report that came out this week, they refer specifically to work requirements in Medicaid because they know that able-bodied people have left the labor force because they can now get Medicaid coverage.
Sandy Tice?
The majority of people who benefited, able-bodied adults who benefited from Medicaid expansion, are already working. Many of them are working two jobs. And the reason why they're eligible for Medicaid is because the minimum wage in Ohio right now is $8.10 an hour. If we come in and we scale back Medicaid, more people are going to get their health care through the hospital emergency rooms. And hospitals don't get the reimbursement that they would get from a private insurance company for people. Hospital costs are going to go up, and then hospital jobs are going to go down. Every reputable study that has looked at the impact this would have on the health care sector shows that lots of jobs would be lost.
You know, when this all started back in 2010, the discussions about ACA, about, you know, slash Obamacare, the opioid epidemic wasn't what it is today. It was out there, but it was way under the radar. Is it a topic of conversation? There have to be lots of members of Congress who are much more attuned to the issue today than they were 7 years ago.
No, absolutely. I mean, it is a major public health problem issue in this country. I want to say it is the number one killer of people under 50.
Yeah.
The opioid addiction, and that is not enough money right now in the bill. And you've got one thing to think about, too, in the broader context is the amount of deficit reduction in the Senate bill is about $200 billion more than what's in the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
The thought is that Senator McConnell's majority leader will use that to sweeten the pot, perhaps on treatment for opioid addiction, for senators like Rob Portman of Ohio or Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia or Susan Collins of Maine and so on, to try to win them over, that maybe that is one of the key negotiating points. But no, it's absolutely there, because this is a cost that falls on state and local health government, mm-hmm. Systems. And also, you have to remember the Medicaid expansion we talked about, that's been financing a lot of this opioid addiction treatment.
Yeah.
And if that money is capped, right, if states have less money to work with, they have to look at who's on the Medicaid rolls, how much do they pay their providers, the hospitals and the doctors, what services are covered. Medicaid is one of the most expensive line items for states. It's up there with education,
mm-hmm.
with prisons, with public safety, with road repair. They're
yeah.
going to have to make some pretty serious trade-offs.
Ray Hederman, I mean, does the opioid addiction crisis, is it a game changer when it comes to talking about Medicaid a little bit?
I think you're looking at ways to address the problem. I mean, this bill puts $2 billion in funding. And I think the question is, how can you get the care to these people who need it? You know, and basically,
and Medicaid has been very efficient at doing that.
Right, because it's basically taking a look at some of the older people. I'm not quite sure, you know, Medicaid has been efficient in the sense, if you look at kind of people on Medicaid, how much better off are they at the end of the day? And I think, you know, the basic problem with opioid treatment is we need to look at how these people got addicted in the first place. Sometimes these were people that prescribed the wrong medicine by doctors, you know, people who said, take painkillers for your shoulder surgery. Mm-hmm. Then they became addicted.
Right.
So, and that's kind of indicative, I think, of one of the flaws of our healthcare program, which is we're paying for things, but we're paying for things that don't produce better outcomes for people.
Governor Kasich has said that the billions that Mitch McConnell has promised in grant money to treat opioid addiction, it would be like a few drops in an ocean.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where the governor is getting that money, because I mean, getting that figure, because the fact is this bill allocates billions of dollars specifically to the drug problem. And then, you know, Leader McConnell can allocate more money working with Senator Portman. So I'm not quite sure why, you know, Governor Kasich says it's insufficient when you look at that billions of dollars coming from the federal government compared to how much we're already spending.
Yeah. Sandy Tice, when it comes to opioid addiction, what difference does it make if the money is block grants from the federal government to treat addiction or coming through the Medicaid system?
We can't put a cap on it, especially in a state like Ohio. We have the unfortunate distinction of having the highest number of accidental opioid overdose deaths in America.
Yeah.
And the city of Dayton has the highest per capita number. Between that and our shamefully high infant mortality rate, we have two public health crises that we have not properly targeted or dealt with. People need treatment. We need more treatment beds. We need intensive treatment. That's expensive. And if people don't get it, the public health consequences and the expenses of that will continue to ripple through our economy and cost us even more money and more lives. We need to nip it in the bud.
Mary Agnes Curie, what about Governor Kasich's estimation that it's just a couple drops in an ocean as far as what Mitch McConnell's proposing? Do you know, I mean, how it stacks up?
I don't, but I think just if you look at, there's a $2 billion allotment, which is a one-year expenditure.
Yeah.
But I think if you go back and look at, if you are going to stop the additional funding for the Medicaid expansion, which in general has helped single childless adults get coverage. These may be some of the folks who are getting treatment for this particular condition. If that additional funding for that expansion is gone and states are going to get a capped allotment for their Medicaid expenditures.
How do they divvy it up?
How do they make it up? Exactly. What do they spend it on? And if this is a growing problem in a particular population, let's say you get, I don't know, a 5% uptick in those cases in a particular year, but you are under your per capita cap or your block grant, how do you catch up? How do you get the extra money?
Mary Agnes, the report from the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, indicated that premiums for older people would be much higher under the Senate bill than under current law. And when we talk about premiums for older people, we're talking to people under 65, right, who don't qualify for Medicare.
Right. Yes, the bill would allow those people to be charged as much as five times more than a person perhaps in their 20s. Things seem to start change to charge for older people more as they get into their 40s. But this 5-to-1 ratio could actually be waived if a state wanted to do it differently under those waivers we talked about before, those 1332s. So that is the thought, that as people get older and they cost more to insure. Right now, the Affordable Care Act says you can't charge them more than three times what you charge a younger person. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about at least five times more. So the combination of that higher age-rated premium, plus the fact that the subsidies in the Senate Republican bill would not cover costs as comprehensively as what's in the Affordable Care Act, that's kind of a double whammy on the older folks.
Ray Hederman, I mean, that's got to be a tough sell when lawmakers go back to their districts and try to convince people, because older voters tend to vote more.
Right. You know, and that is a change from the House bill. The House bill had an age-based tax credit system, and now we have an income-based tax credit system to help people purchase insurance. The reason people are making this change, and by the way, Ohio had higher than a 3-to-1 before the ACA, is because you need younger, healthy people in the insurance program to pay their premiums that you then use to pay benefits.
But if you don't require them to do it.
Exactly. And so what happens is, you know, if the premiums are so expensive, right now we're just seeing young, healthy people not in the insurance market, and that has led to a destabilized risk pool on the individual market. So the idea is, lower premiums for younger people, bring them back in. And as CBO says, premiums will go up in the short term in the next year or two, and then they'll start to fall as these younger people reenter the market to stabilize the insurance pool.
Hmm. Sandy Tice?
What I think is very clear is, other than the hardcore conservatives, nobody likes this. The doctors don't like it. The hospitals don't like it. AARP doesn't like it. The left doesn't like it. Why don't they go back to the bargaining table and maybe do something sometimes unheard of, and that's the two parties sit down together, have an open process instead of having, what was it, nine white men behind closed doors?
And now Mitch McConnell is saying they will not go to the Democrats.
That's ridiculous. They need to. This is a two-party system, and they need to bring everybody to the table. Something this important we need to work together on and come up with something that helps the people and that the people support.
Democrats have long said that the Affordable Care Act needed fixes. They said it practically as soon as it was passed. Like a lot of super complicated bills, things change over time, but nothing changed with the ACA because the Republicans wouldn't let it. Mary Agnes Carey, what kind of fixes were they talking about at the time? Was it they tended to have to do with these insurance pools, right?
Well, I think they wanted to look at, for example, you know, the subsidy structure, the way it's set. Under the Affordable Care Act, you get to 400% of poverty. That's around $90,000 for a family of four. And really starting around 350% of poverty, which is somewhat less than that, you really got no help at all. And so that is a big problem. Also, in the individual market, about 10 million people are getting help, or it's a little bit higher than 10 million on the ACA, but you have a chunk of people in the individual market that get no help at all. They get, because of their income is too high. They are finding this health insurance extremely unaffordable. Mm-hmm. How do you help those people? That's one of the key things. I think looking at trying to address the affordability question, how it would work. Another problem with the Affordable Care Act that is the Republicans in the Senate are trying to address is they brought in the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies are for people that are 100% to 400% of the poverty line. If you earn below 100% of poverty, that's below about $14,000 a year, you're supposed to get coverage under Medicaid. But if your state didn't expand Medicaid under the ACA, because remember, the Supreme Court made that optional.
And about 20 states didn't, right?
Right. So that's like 2.5 million people that don't have coverage. So that's called the coverage gap. They'd want to address that. The Senate Republican bill has said their subsidies can go down to 0% of poverty. But the problem is, because the subsidies are not as generous, the plans don't cover as much under the Senate Republican plan as they do under the ACA. The requirements, even on some of these lower income people, to make certain payments and some of their deductibles and copays, even with the cost sharing assistance, the CBO was questioning whether even some of those lower income folks would get in the game. So I think if you ever had a House Republican or I beg your pardon, Republicans and Democrats sit down to work on the ACA, these would be a couple of those issues. But it's such a politically volatile issue that seems just like it's not going to happen.
Mary Agnes Curie, I think the last time I said goodbye to you, I said, I hope you'll come back. I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to. It'd be great.
Mary Agnes Curie, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Sandy Tice, executive director of Progress Ohio, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ann.
And Ray Hederman, executive vice president of the Buckeye Institute, thanks to you as well.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
Thanks for listening. That's it. All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.